Good day, everyone. Welcome to the CSU Relentless Gardener Podcast. I am Colorado State University horticultural specialist Linda Langelo, and joining me today is Carrie Tomlinson, CSU Urban and Community Forester at Spur Campus. Now let's get to the heart of it, where we explore the topic of climate-adapted trees and turf conversion and possibly other benefits of trees. Hello, Carrie.
Hey, Linda, how's it going?
It's good, it's good. So the cold weather is gone
Maybe.
For now, and our trees are going to have to survive on the other end of the scale of 62 or 70 degrees, right?
That's right. That's right. They go from negative 10 up to 60 sometimes on the same day. So our trees are very, very tortured and have to be tough around here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's look at your turf conversion. So why is turf conversion becoming a priority in Colorado?
Yeah, I would say turf conversion has been kind of an ongoing process for Colorado. You know, Colorado has always kind of led the way with water conservation strategies for the obvious reasons that Colorado is a very dry place, and we're also the headwaters of most of the basin that supports the southern part of the United States for water. And so we are restricted in some ways of using so much water, and we definitely want to make sure that we are doing our best to actually conserve as much water as possible. In terms of, you know, usage right now, most estimates say that about half of the water that is used in local municipalities is being used to water grass. And so to try to conserve that water, there's been an effort, ongoing effort over the last couple decades, actually, to convert that turf to something more water friendly. And so what's happened is, I would say, kind of a hit or miss process with that, because when it comes to turf conversion, like, you know, probably in the 90s, those time periods, like, there was a lot of experimenting going on with different varieties, things like that. And also, you know, xeriscape kinds of plantings. So, but what has happened recently is, you know, people, that message has resonated with them, which is great. However, there's a lot of misunderstanding about trees and tree roots in terms of turf conversion. And so people are doing severe damage to their trees without knowing it a lot of times with the turf conversion. And many, many times the cheap method to that is to, as you know, I hear you laughing, Linda, is to take a what's called a dingo or a skid steer or a turf cutter.
No.
Yeah, I know. They go to town on their lawn and taking out all the turf. And then a lot of times they'll spray it with herbicide of some sort, and then they'll just pile rocks on top of it. So the poor tree, tree's roots, if you don't know, are actually mostly in the top 12 inches or 24 inches, depending on species, of soil. And so the first layer of damage that happens is that the turf cutter or skid steer cuts all the feeder roots for the tree off. And then they basically run over the roots that are left over and over and over and over and over again with a piece of machinery until those roots are dead. Because if you know anything about roots, the ones that matter are the ones you can't see very, very well. They're those hair-like, tiny, tiny roots that actually do the hard work of absorption for water and nutrients for the tree. And by compacting them over and over again, basically creating a parking lot in your front yard, then those roots get damaged or killed. And so, yeah, so we're seeing this all over the place.
So then, how often does the tree recover from that? Because, you know, sure, if it's missing some of the feeder roots or the absorption roots, then fine. But you know, if it's like 90%, that tree is very stressed for a very long time or doomed.
No, that's a great question because a lot of people will go, oh, my tree survived. It's fine after that happened. But you have to realize trees live very, very slowly and they die very slowly. I don't know if you're a fan of Lord of the Rings and that sort of thing, Linda. Yeah, okay. I figured. You know, they had the character, the Ents, right? That were the big trees. And they would they talk really slow, you know, and that was a great feature of this because I thought, oh, that's perfect, because that kind of is how trees are, right? They're very slow in terms of how they grow, how they uptake nutrients and things, and how they respond to stresses. And so if you remove every single root off of a tree, then the tree will immediately tap into any carbohydrate, enzymes, proteins it has stored, which usually is in the root system, sometimes in the trunk, depending on species, and it will regenerate as many roots as it can. They're hard to kill, right? They really, especially big trees, they will use every resource left to actually try to regenerate those roots before they die. But what you're doing is you're withdrawing funds that the tree does not have a bank account for. And a lot of times you'll see a flush of roots, but that is his last hurrah. That is the last bit of energy that tree has to survive, right? And so people go, oh, the roots regrew, or it's doing okay, or look at all these branches. When an arborist will look at that tree and go, oh my gosh, that tree is dying, right? Because it's epicormic sprouting, it's root sprouting, it's having all these interior branches develop, it's losing all the buds on the ends of the branches, things like that. And that's all that energy redirection to try to make up for the loss of those roots. And so a tree that would have lived 100 years then lives 3 or 5 or 10. And so, yeah, so people don't realize the damage that they're doing a lot of times, because it will take a long time for a big tree to die after that damage.
So they might as well have been hit by a hailstorm and a pretty brutal one. No, seriously.
Totally. Yeah.
Oh,
Reminds
man.
me of what happened in Yuma. Yeah, like looking at those trees, like those are doing the same exact thing. When you knock every single bud off of a tree, every single leaf off of a tree, those trees will go, oh, well, like that was a hit, but I'm gonna try to dip into every bit of reserve energy I have and regenerate. And a lot of times it's gonna be the last time you see it come out.
Well, it's almost like think about what your consequences are of your actions and, you know, stand back and take a look at the big picture because that really wasn't the big picture. That was like, you know, this, I don't want to say faddish idea, but this thing to, oh, wow, this is like the panacea solution for, you know, saving water and this is going to be great. And then, you know, I've seen people come along and put fabric and then rock on it.
Yeah, that's what people do to prevent weeds, but we both know that weed fabric is very temporary in terms of its protection from weeds, and then the weeds are way harder to get out at that point too. So you convert your landscape that maybe just had, you know, some patches of grass or that sort of thing, or mulch around that tree, hopefully, to something that you're now going to have to maintain. And a lot of times that maintenance involves a lot more herbicide or physical labor because you're pulling weeds out of that area. And like I said, that takes a while too, because soil will start to build up between the rocks that you poured on there. And that soil will then retain moisture and will be a great place for a weed to actually plant itself.
It's a never-ending cycle.
Never-ending cycle. So yeah, you kind of have to pick or choose like what battles you fight. But I think, like I said, it's all through good intentions. People are really trying to save water, and they understand that the criticalness of our water situation in Colorado. And so, you know, I think it's all done with good intentions.
Oh,
It's
yeah.
just we can do it better. And so I think for us at CSU Spur and the Urban Forestry Hub that we have there, Community Forestry, that we do there and the research that we do there. We're looking at doing a training series to actually address exactly the techniques you need to do both, to be friendly to your tree and be able to conserve water by doing this kind of landscaping in a more kind of tree friendly manner. And so, how can you do it? Well, a lot of cities, Fort Collins included, I think Boulder included, could include a couple other cities actually have criteria for installing or uninstalling turf underneath trees in during construction. And so that includes hand removal. So instead of taking a turf cutter or a skid steer to those areas of critical roots underneath the tree, you actually use a hoe and take it out. And the reason you want to do that is because all of those anchoring roots and larger roots that are on the surface, they'll all get shaved off by a skid steer or a turf cutter. Now you're going to damage some actual critical roots when you do that, but it's going to be a whole lot less than what you do with a machine. And so people go, "Really? I have to use a hoe?" And I'm like, "Yeah, you do." But I tell you what, a lot of the contractors here in Fort Collins and other areas are used to that, and they're like, they're actually very proud of making sure that they're protecting those historic trees. You know, trees are hard to grow, like we talked about here in Colorado, and they're an immense resource. They help to save water by their shading and cooling. They produce all the benefits of, having the higher property values, stormwater offset in terms of retention value, all of the, wildlife and pollinator species and other kinds of plants and animals that use our trees for wildlife in the urban settings and community settings. All of these things, are part of the value of trees and completely overshadow the value of the changing out of turf for rocks. And so I think it's just a matter of kind of realizing that value and then putting forth the effort to preserve those roots as much as you can.
Well, you and I have talked about, trees are part of the hydrology cycle, and without them, it's not going to rain. And, we're dry enough as it is out here, so we definitely need to take care of them because, mature trees are going to benefit us a lot more than a young sapling. Not that the young sapling doesn't, but, there's
Yeah, totally.
And it takes so long for it to become, and all the adversity it has to go through before it gets to be mature. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, people don't realize, our trees in Colorado are much older than the same size of tree in other parts of the United States because they grow slower. And like you said, they have a shorter growing season. They have much more environmental challenges to get through. And then on top of that, in terms of impacts that they get from the urban setting too, like if a tree makes it to 100 here, it's really amazing. And so like it's a real tragedy to lose a 100-year-old tree after 2 years of turf conversion, when the intention most likely was not to do that. I have seen people use 2,4-D to kill off weeds and then kill their tree. Big beautiful street trees in Fort Collins. I've seen people use a landscaper that had no idea that they were actually doing damage to the tree, and stopping them repetitively by telling them they had to use hand tools. They don't want to do that. They're not used to that. They want to get it done in a certain time period, and I understand that, but I also understand that that loss is tragic in terms of that tree. So I have a tree, honey locust. It is my favorite tree because it saves me so much money, Linda, in terms of shading my house. It has it's probably a 30-foot tall tree. It's most likely 20 years old, 25 years old, and I pay probably $30 a month in the summer for my electric because it
Wow.
shades my house. Yeah.
You want to
Yeah.
sell? You want to sell?
No, I don't. And I can't. Yeah. It's amazing.
I planted a bur oak, I think it
Yeah.
was the 5 years ago, and someday it will shade the west side of the house without actually looming over the house because it has enough space to do so. But in the meantime, no, I'm not. Yeah, my bill isn't $30.
Well, it's a great choice of tree though, bur oak. It'll get big. It'll be a 200-year-old tree someday, hopefully, fingers crossed. Both you and I won't be here to see it, but that's okay.
But isn't that why we do it? I mean,
That's
it's for the
exactly.
future. I mean, drought tolerant, it's native, it attracts all kinds of birds. I mean, the list goes on, So, anyway.
No, I really do feel like, being an arborist and a community forester is one of those things that like we give back in so many ways, like by planting trees. Like we really do provide for the future generations by doing that. And it's a selfless act, and I think it's an act that connects you to to everyone, to the future, to the past, to the present, and it makes you, I guess, rooted, if you will, pun intended. It makes you rooted in the community in which you're at, that you are vested
Yes.
there to look out for it, right?
Yes.
So,
Yes.
yeah, totally.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, what steps would you recommend to ensure trees are protected during all this turf conversion?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I would say, initially, you probably want to get, if you have one available, which I know where you're at, Linda, is a little bit tough, an arborist to come out and actually look. I know, an ISA certified arborist. If you go to treesaregood.com, that's the ISA website for anybody looking for an arborist. You put in your zip code and it'll tell you the closest arborist to you. Here in Colorado, we have over 500 certified arborists, believe it or not. Many of them are working for companies and are, actually doing arboriculture work on a daily basis. Some of them, like me, are working for programming and kind of a institutional, say at CSU, that sort of thing, or at cities. But there's certainly plenty of them out there in terms of finding expertise. You can always call one too and send them pictures and say, "This is what I have. What do you think?" And so they can give you their opinion. Also, we are starting an arborist school at CSU Spur. It started this past week. We're on our second week now, where we are training more certified arborists to do this. And of course, we'll have the turf conversion training we're going to do. And with that, we'll have materials for that. But you are also welcome anytime to call Colorado State Forest Service and ask for the Urban and Community Forestry Group. We now have four foresters, myself included, that can help answer questions related to turf conversion. many cities right now, there's a state law called SB 5 that passed last year that actually mandates new, yeah, it mandates in new construction. On the right of way and HOAs, on state properties, in multifamily construction, in the larger kind of developments, new developments that they plant, a xeriscape or a water-friendly turf. So with that, though, I have asked them to modify that to include that during that process that they have to have an ISA certified arborist overlook their tree preservation efforts. And so that would make a requirement for those folks to send their landscape plan to an ISA certified arborist to make sure that those details are put in there to protect the trees while they're doing that turf conversion. And part of that includes making sure the tree is watered after they do the turf conversion. A lot of people believe that if you convert your turf, all you have to do is water it the first year or maybe two for that grass to get established, and then you don't have to water it anymore. If you do that to your tree and you had an irrigation system there before, your tree will slowly die. And so it might get a bug infestation, it might show signs of stress with apocrine resprouting or dieback or limb drop, random limb drop, things like that that you're like, oh, this must have been the wind or this. But it's as a result of cutting that water off. So we're also asking that that those systems also include some historic levels of watering to the tree. So you can save a lot of money, not watering the rest of your lawn, but you still need to water your tree because that offset, what you gain and having that tree there in terms of shading and cooling, is now research proven by a study done in 2021 by the Rocky Mountain Research Station. By a woman named Melissa McHale that worked at CSU, who studied water usage here in Fort Collins of areas that were canopy shaded versus those that were not in terms of landscape water usage. And what it showed was a very distinct water savings on areas that had canopy versus those that didn't, which makes total sense. If you have that area partially shaded during the day, you're not going to lose as much water, right? Common sense, right? If yeah, if
Right.
it's exactly, but you still have enough sun for your turf, you just don't have to water it as much.
And it's the same idea that I tell people about having one indoor plant in a place versus three or four or five, that the humidity level helps the one that needs the most humidity. Okay. And so it's the same concept with an outdoor tree, right?
There you go. There you go. Exactly the same. And so, yeah, where you have green, more green tends to grow, right? And so, ta-da. So, yeah, in terms of that, you can actually save a lot more water by keeping your tree there and preserving it and doing your turf conversion in a safe manner than you can if you take it out or if you kill it. Right. And what you'll notice too is if you kill it within 3 years of doing your turf conversion, or maybe within 3 weeks, depending on if you used herbicides or not for topical treatment. But yeah, if you did kill your tree as a result of that, your water usage, even with friendly turf, is going to go up.
Yeah, unfortunately. And we had, when I went to school, we had a landscape architect, and we took landscape design, and he said, just go out in nature and observe what's happening. And so if you go out, even if it's your own backyard, and you watch different times of the day, and you see the difference between, if you go by somebody's lawn, they have three or four trees in their front lawn. They don't water as much most of the time anyway. Some people do overwater still, but you see the fact that, oh wow, the grass is healthier and greener, and they're not turning their irrigation on. So
Right. Well,
then,
and
yeah.
yeah, totally. You totally nailed it, Linda. I apologize.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but yeah, in terms of that, there's a forester named Donna. I don't, you probably know Donna,
Oh,
but
yes.
So she has a great saying that I love, which is to establish a tree in Colorado, you just need to use as much water as you flush the toilet once a week. So
Oh my gosh. Oh wow, that's unforgettable, isn't it?
yeah, you can remember that. You're like, oh, I flushed the toilet. That's as much water as you need. Because there's also a misconception out there that trees use up a lot of water. And there's a lot of debate about that. And I would say if it's a cottonwood or a willow, absolutely they use up more water because they're water-loving, floodplain species that grow next to streams and next to floodplains. And so they have the rooting and aggressive rooting systems to find that water to you, which is why you do not want to plant them next to your sewer line or your sidewalk or your foundation of your house. So, yeah, but like, go ahead, Linda. Sorry.
Well, I tell people, think of the origin of where that tree came from. And that is always going to be part of the genetics. I mean, you could hybridize and breed and all of that, but it's still going to be there. And
That's right.
so pay attention to that and treat it like, it's an original environment.
Yeah, absolutely correct. So we always go, as foresters, we know where trees come from, right? And this is why
Right.
foresters are in the urban setting, is because we know that information, right? And so we don't plant willow trees, we don't plant cottonwood trees in the urban setting. People go, why don't you plant natives, right? They're adapted to this area. And I'm like, well, because we really like to live in houses.
Oh, that's a good answer. That I like that.
Houses. Because
Yeah.
all
Okay.
the native trees are what? Because we don't need houses. But yeah, I know I'm a little bit snarky, but in terms of that, we have infrastructure. We have sewer lines, water lines,
Yes.
irrigation lines, sidewalks, curb lines, stormwater structures, detention ponds, like all these things that we have to make sure we're planting the right tree that's not going to damage those things in the future, and planting them in the right place too.
Well, I've told this story on other podcasts, but I had a sewage line replaced, and the guys that came in couldn't understand, because they've never seen this before in their lives, why there was no impediment as far as trees and shrubs from the house to the back of the property where they had to dig this hole, and they were just absolutely amazed. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to have an issue, and I didn't want them to come and try to dig it up and move it and put it back. No. And so I don't want the issue for anybody else in the future. So they were just baffled, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you do a good job of choosing the right tree, putting it in the right place, you won't have issues with roots in your sewer line. And so, yeah, that's a great example, and I'm glad you said that, because I hear that all the time, like, well, trees are bad, they get in my sewer line. I'm like, well, what kind of tree was it? And it's like, oh, it was a cottonwood. Well, there you go, or a silver maple, or
Not to be snarky
yeah,
myself, but
there you go.
the tree didn't walk there.
Yeah, tree didn't walk there. Well, I've actually testified as an expert witness in court, and they're like, well, the tree. Trees always end up in the tree. I'm like, no, there are no drill bits on the ends of those roots.
My gosh. Oh.
Like, did you hear that buzzing sound? That's the tree drilling through your sewer line. No, that's not how it happens, right?
And
Like, yeah.
the judge said,
And the judge
okay.
said, okay, snark pants, major point. Yeah, so
Okay.
I think in terms of that, like, you have to realize what the physiology of the tree, like you said, the natural characteristics of that tree, and why we do not plant them because of that. And our native species are very aggressive rooters. They're very brittle wooded, and although they're wonderful in areas where they can spread out and do their thing, and I
Yeah.
love them for
Yeah.
that, they're not good for sidewalk plantings, downtown plantings, most park settings around where people are doing having small spaces, parking lots, things like that. But out in the open areas, like, you can't beat a cottonwood, a native cottonwood, in Colorado.
Yeah.
They are number one trees for our birds that are predator species that require them for nesting and roosting. And you can always find, if you're looking for an eagle nest, that's where they're at, is they're up in our cottonwood trees. So we need them, but we have to put them where they belong, which is along our streamside corridors and things like that. But I think in terms of, like, the turf conversion, things like that, most of the species that we would recommend in Colorado, which is like the Front Range recommended tree list, there's recommended tree guides in a lot of the municipalities now, things like that, are going to have species that are water friendly, that do not require, especially past establishment, a great deal of water. If you think about, again, back to the Ents in the Lord of the Rings, trees live slow, they die slow and they do other processes fairly slow. So if you think of the trunk and the roots as kind of like a one-way pump that's constantly, continually actively putting water into the system, and keeping it there, right? It has back valves to prevent it from losing the water, right? Depending on the species you're talking about, those processes will retain water and then uptake it when it's available. And so trees are designed, and especially the ones we put in urban and community settings, to be tough and actually be able to withstand moments of drought for a certain amount of time. You'll see them shut down. You'll see them go dormant a lot of times, but then you'll see them come back. And so the species that mostly are recommended nowadays in urban settings are going to be ones that have some toughness to them. And this leads into our next topic, actually, the climate resilient trees.
Okay. Well, there's two quick things. Mulch,
Yep, totally.
in the conversion, and out here, we have to use be very careful where we use the mulch because it'll blow into Kansas or Nebraska by the time, but and then ground covers that you would use as well after the turf conversion.
Yes. And different parts of the state are going to do things differently,
Sure.
right? In terms of those ground covers. I will say, I prefer, always prefer, what I call ugly mulch or arborist mulch over any store-bought mulch. Research shows that, excuse me, recently chipped wood from arborists actually gives you the best response in trees because that nitrogen and carbon ratios are really good. Obviously, it's part of a tree that you're using, and so those that nitrogen can be uptook by the tree very quickly. So, and also chunky ugly mulch doesn't blow away as easy. So, if you do some due diligence and kind of tamp it down, not like with a like a tamper or anything like that, but just like just like give it a good squish, right? And use chunky mulch and not like cypress mulch or something like that, because that stuff blows away pretty quick.
I think it's called there's a gorilla mulch
Gorilla mulch, yeah.
that is not completely shredded, and I don't know whether it's pine or exactly or not, but it does really hold together in our high winds and things.
There you go.
I've seen it used out at Ballyneal Golf Course in Holyoke out here.
Yeah, that works really well. That is one you can buy from the store too. So, but yeah, in terms of mulch, the chunkier the better, and also the slower it breaks down because of that chunkiness. So it'll last a little bit longer once you apply it. But yeah, keeping that moisture level up as a result of the mulching really is helpful. Also helps with weeds. It's not going to prevent bindweed from invading that area, but in terms of that that weeding process, I've mulched the heck out of my locust that I love, and I can pull bindweed out that is literally like 3 feet long from the ground much easier than I can when it's just not mulched. So definitely helps with that process.
So yeah,
Yeah.
let's go to the climate adapted trees. I'm sure folks want to hear about those.
Yeah. So we've have kind of like an idea, a program that we've started. We're partnering with Plant Select, Ross Shrigley there at Plant Select, and we have a graduate student and at the College of Ag Sciences, and we've been working on this idea and written a grant. Hopefully, we'll find out if we got funded in March. But the idea is that we would develop and promote species that are actually modeled to do well here in Colorado over the next 30 to 80 years. With the climate-based models that we have right now for Colorado by Colorado, we're looking at some pretty drastic changes to our climate over the next several decades. And so, just like the pioneers who came here and planted trees that they brought from the East Coast, like American elm and ash, they were looking at replicating their home that they came from and putting in these trees that they thought would grow here, and many of them did. We have to look towards the future also and bring in trees that we think are going to grow here in the next 100 years based on those changes that are accelerating faster than we thought they would based on models even a few years ago. So, with that in mind, we are looking at latitudes that are more in alignment with like the I-40 corridor, right? So, Panhandle of Texas, Oklahoma, northern New Mexico, those areas in terms of plants and species that we can bring here that we think will grow when our climate gets hotter and drier and colder. So people go, oh, global warming, like why is it colder? Well, because there's more moisture in the atmosphere and the jet stream is no longer as strong as it was, separating us from the cold Arctic air. So it's allowing things to come down here in the winter time and get really cold. We do have a history of really cold eras though in Colorado. Negative 30 is not unheard of. The cherries that were very commonly grown here in the early part of the century all froze as a result of one freeze one winter. And so, we do have those here. So we have to have trees that go as low as negative 30 and as high as like 105. And to find those, we have to look for those really tough environments that exist in those areas of the United States. So a lot of examples that are already here. One is Gila Monster, the oak species that was brought in from New Mexico. Obviously, Gila, named after Gila Mountains. And so, in terms of those species that are becoming more common and more available in the nursery industry, we are going to be working with Plant Select to find them and grow them, and then also promote a system that Plant Select has to actually enable people to buy the trees while they're in the nursery process. And what that will do is it will take the risk away from the growers, because right now they take a lot of gambles as to what they grow, whether or not it will be popular enough for people to buy in 5 years or 3 years, right? Like, how do you know what tree will be popular in 3 years? Well, they don't. And so they're actually projecting out what they think will be a good species. And so we're going to try to take the guess work out of that, right? By using climate-based science to do
Well,
that.
I think it's more about necessity. People need to look at as necessity. If you wanted Kentucky bluegrass, stay in PA or Kentucky. I mean, honestly, seriously, because I was raised in Pennsylvania, and so that was enough rainfall and everything for that grass. And out here, it's not the right thing. It's not the right choice. And so
Well, and they're,
it's time. It's reckoning time is here.
yeah, reckoning time is here, absolutely. And with the water shortages, water prices going up, certainly there's some towns where even setting a meter costs over $60,000. Like this is, yeah, I kid you not, like this is becoming a critical point. And so to your point, Kentucky bluegrass, there is a new, I wouldn't say new, but it's now available as a turf called Tahoma, Tahoma 31. It was actually developed by my alma mater, Oklahoma State University. But it's being grown by some turf suppliers now here in Colorado, and it requires 70% less water. Now, if you know about Bermuda, I know about Bermuda because I grew up in Oklahoma, but yeah, it's very aggressive. It will grow pretty much anywhere, but it usually is a warm season grass. So you won't have it growing where you get our cold temperatures. But what they've done is they've hybridized it. So it actually has a lot of cold hardiness to it. So it can withstand some of our winters without dying. And I hopefully all of our winters without dying. But in terms of that, like it's still, still being proven in some ways. But I think it's a good option, it's a great option. And so 70% less water. If Bermuda stays green until it gets kind of cold and then it goes dormant. And so then, in the winter you have dormant grass, and then in the spring it comes back. And so a little bit of water makes it nice bright green. So I think there are some options. There are some options.
Well, and that's just, again, it's changing our perspective. I mean, if we want to stay here and we want to do well here, we have to adapt just like the plants do. And so, we're figuring it out. Breeding is a good thing in a lot of ways. It's not, there's a lot of breeding that people want something that's more floriferous and insect free and all that. Well, there's no magic bullet for that. You know, it takes a
Fully.
process. It takes a process. So,
And you have to measure what energy level you have to put towards that too, right? Like if it's your home landscape, like a lot of people work multiple jobs now. A lot of people are counting pennies. And so how much money do you have to put towards that kind of thing, right? And so I think coming up with good options, if you can safely replace your turf, have a nice shade tree that you don't have to water, put in some water-friendly turf that you water once a year, and then have a nice green lawn that you mow maybe 3 times a year and call it good. Heck yeah, that's way better than mowing every week.
oh yeah, exactly. Well, let me ask you, what role does tracking tree provenance using blockchain and QR codes play
That's a great question.
in helping communities with these climate adapted trees? What's the purpose?
No, I love it. So that's all this new system that Plant Select is developing. They're still in the works putting it together, but blockchain allows for a kind of like a certificate, if you will. It's a pedigree that will say that this tree is guaranteed that it came from that place. And what that does, this is unheard of in the nursery industry, because a lot of times you'll buy a tree, not all the time, but sometimes if you get it, especially from a large supplier, and not your local nursery, or even your local nursery, sometimes you ask, okay, where's this tree from? They're like, I have no idea, but it is the right species that you asked for.
Well,
So, yeah.
let me interrupt you. I mean,
Go ahead, go ahead.
Monrovia, yeah,
Monrovia.
Monrovia in California. I mean, you go to a lot of places and you read the tag, and I'm going, oh, I thought this was a local nursery, with local, where they, yeah, no. And so, yeah, it's like you're saying, it's the right tree you asked for. But it was raised in a location there that it's never probably going to adapt to here.
So that's the problem is, well, and even the nurseries don't even know the what's called provenance. Provenance is where a tree originated from, right? And so naturally, right? And so it has, like you said before, that genetic capacity to adapt and have the skills metabolically to adapt to the challenges that exist in that environment. So the two big challenges for us in the plant world are heat tolerance and cold tolerance, right? And so we use hardiness zone maps, now we have heat hardiness zone maps too. There's all kinds of ways to kind of figure out, based only on species, whether that tree will live there. Now, here's the getter. If you get a tree that's actually from southern Florida and you plant it, a bald cypress, say, and you plant it in Pennsylvania, it's gonna think it's still in Florida. And it's not going to adapt as well to the conditions in Pennsylvania. And so the same thing goes for maples, red maples, any kind of oak, elm trees. We don't know, even the nurseries don't know where these are from, what we call provenance originally. And so it's always a mystery. You plant a tree and you're like, oh, it's doing so great for 5 years. And then all of a sudden we get a freeze and it's dead. And you're like, what happened? I watered it. I took care of it. I was a good tree steward. Like it died. Well, it just may not have been genetically capable to adapt to the conditions that you put it in, even though on your little hardiness zone map it says that red maple should grow there. So to kind of end this issue, blockchain allows for a tree and or plant to be labeled with a QR code that says originally where it came from. And so with each line of custody you have with blockchain, when it changes hands, that data stays with it. And then when you get it, you have a little pedigree that says where it's from. So you can say, okay, this will go here.
Well, that's like tracing your roots. You know,
Tracy.
the genealogy of my tree is it started in, oh, Peru, ended up in Florida, and went to New York.
There you go. There you go. Ended up in New York. Yeah. So, like, your QR code would say that lineage, Linda. So, yeah, I think in terms of that, like, this is going to change the nursery industry. And I'll tell you how, other than during that blockchain process, you can buy that tree. So you're like, hey, I want a tree that I know is going to live here for the next 100 years, right? That's the kind of tree I like to plant because I like to think of what I do as important.
Yes. Oh,
I guess,
absolutely.
right?
Yes.
I want to know what I do matters and that it's going to go on beyond me. And so I think this is going to be, Cabbage Patch dolls. You remember those,
Oh,
Linda?
absolutely. Yes.
So right now, people choose their tree in Colorado based on one really big characteristic, and that's a lot of times fall color, believe it or not. They'll go, ooh, that's pretty. I want one of those. And they'll go to the nursery and go, give me one of those. And they're like, oh, here you go. Here's your silver maple. So we go, no. But or your autumn blaze, that's the number one variety right now. Don't plant one of those. They're not good long-term trees for us. But again, we don't even know where they're from, right? They're probably hybridized in some nursery somewhere and then end up here. But I think in terms of that, like, you'll have a little QR code and a certificate that will come with your tree that says your tree provenance was from this place and it should tolerate these conditions. And I'll tell you, here's the cool thing. Oh, I raised my hand and now it's raising the hand on Zoom. Here's the cool thing. It actually will show you exactly to the degree how much cold hardiness it has and how much hot hardiness. And I'll tell you how. In the past, it's been all anecdotal, right? We're like, oh, did the such and such survive here? No. And so, okay, draw the map. It says we have people that said that that tree didn't survive. And so it's been all just kind of based on history of people's experiences. But now we have science. At CSU Spur, we have the research grove that's being developed by College of Ag Sciences that has and will have sensor data on it to measure exactly how much water use these trees are using. It'll have, and they're currently doing a sampling to actually be able to measure exactly to the degree what cold level will cause the tree to fail. So they have a new process. It's not totally new. It's been used for other kinds of crop sciences and things in nursery sciences, but now it's being used for community trees. And so we can actually freeze these tissue samples down by the degree and show exactly when the cellular tissue breaks down based on the degree. And so this will tell us exactly where these trees will fail. And we can create in that QR code, we can put that information in there to tell you exactly when the tree will fail. Yeah. And using, of course, climate science, we can project out what those degree highs and lows will be over the next 30, 80, 100 years. Well, if we're, I think we're underestimating to some level. But like in terms of those projections, we can at least have an educated guess as to where these trees will end up. So we're hoping to start that this after we hear back about our grant this next March. We're currently looking at alternative funding sources and things too. But like the science is ongoing. Like we are the College of Ag Sciences with Dr. Dan Burcham and also Dr. John Martin are currently working on that right now at CSU Spur. And so I'm so excited about the preliminary data that they're getting because it is really cool and really interesting. But yeah, this is the future of nursery.
It looks promising.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit before we wrap up about emerald ash borer
Yeah.
and give us a brief update on where it
Yeah.
is in the state and what's happening.
Yeah. It's a great question. You know, a lot of people knew about the different educational efforts that went on a few years ago, like Your Ash Was on the Line and things like that, and the Denver Metro. And so a lot of people are knowledgeable about emerald ash borer. And then many people did the due diligence of treating their ash trees or getting their ash trees checked for EAB during that time. But we've kind of gotten to the point where that time period of initial kind of emphasis is waning. And so a lot of people are knowledgeable about it, but the initial treatments that they did are wearing off. And also, our climate continues to be a challenge for our ash trees here. So, in terms of that, that's creating this kind of perfect storm of situations in which we're seeing more spread of EAB within Colorado. Certainly, states Kansas and Nebraska both have seen more spread on their western regions, which then correlate with the eastern regions of Colorado. And we certainly have seen some towns anecdotally report that they have seen EAB. So we are kind of starting to spread the word again that EAB is an issue. You know, EAB is a terminal illness to some extent for ash trees. You know, there's been some experimentation and some marginal success with once the tree gets it, you know, whether it was inoculated with EB, which is emamectin benzoate, whether it will survive. And there's been some evidence to say that the trees can elongate their lives, even if they are infected, if you do treat them. But, you know, it eventually takes over the tree. So, with that, we just want to make sure that ash trees are treated by a certified arborist on a minimum of a 3 or 4 year cycle. Sometimes 4 is plenty for treatment. If they are historic trees or large trees, that sort of thing that you want to preserve and keep intact, it's really important to consider treating them. Certainly, trees under 8 inches a lot of times cannot be treated because they are just not eligible for that treatment option. They're just too small. So, in terms of the, you know, it's important to kind of keep track of where your ash trees are, where the important ash trees are, and actually kind of do due diligence of doing some treatment. If your tree has emerald ash borer, you'll see dieback, you'll see a lot of woodpecker activity. You'll see the tree just slowly and sometimes quickly, depending on you know, drought situations, things like that, go down. And those, it's really important to remove them and dispose of the wood properly, which includes chipping. Once the wood is chipped, it doesn't really present a hazard to other trees. But if you try to move that wood and use it for firewood or store it as firewood, you will inoculate all the trees around that firewood pile. So it's important to either bury or chip or take it to the landfill, anything like that, the wood if you do have EAB.
Well, thanks for that update, and thanks for coming on and joining me
Yeah.
today.
Yeah, no, super fun. Always fun to hang out with you, Linda. Appreciate everything you do, and you know, far eastern parts of Colorado, you're just holding down the fort out there doing awesome things. And so, my pleasure,
Thank
absolutely
you.
my pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Thanks for what you're doing.
absolutely.
And thank you to the listening audience for joining in. Tune in next time when we get to the heart of the matter on another horticultural topic.